suffering and an end to suffering. Clarifying the nature of suffering, of stress and unsatisfactoriness, if we translate dukkha in that way, and supporting us and nurturing an end to suffering. This is what practice, what Zen practice, what the Buddha's teaching and practice are about. And as the Heart Sutra states, clearly seeing being the emptiness of all the five conditions and thus relieving all suffering, so-called our suffering, your suffering, and so-called the suffering of all beings. Nothing more except what might assist and enable and clarify this practice of suffering and end to suffering. We can go into all sorts of directions and misdirections if they distract us from this matter of suffering, derail us from taking care of suffering, end of suffering, then we are creating trouble and clouding our vision, blinding ourselves, blinding this heart, mind, life that we are. So we have all sorts of reminders. One that I came across recently that I thought was particularly good is, quote, the whole entire world is a very narrow bridge, and the main thing is to have no fear at all. Remember, in the Heart Sutra reminds us, no hindrance, therefore no fear. And yet we live in a world where there's all sorts of circumstances that make difficulties for us in the sense that we react to them in all sorts of ways. One of them is the turmoil between people and now between nations. We have a number of ongoing wars right now in the world, to name two particularly brutal ones. There's the war between Russia and Ukraine, and there's the war between Israel and Hamas. Israel, Hamas, and Hezbollah. So I thought I'd bring up something I mentioned recently, the sutra's discussion of war in the time of Buddha and some of the events and the things that the Buddha said and did in connection with that. As I mentioned, there's a number of different versions of this in the sutras, but I'll review a fairly common aspects of it. So, the Buddha was a member of the Shakya tribe and lived in Kapilavastu. He was a, what we would call a prince, minor nobility, but prince. And he lived among royalty in Kapilavastu with his father, King Suddhodana, and his stepmother, Mahapajapati, and many cousins, both among the Shakyas and with various other kingdoms. And there's all sorts of relationships, some that go well and some that go not so well. And many of the Buddha's early disciples are relatives, cousins, family members. Again, some of the relationships go well, some of them don't. For instance, another prince of the Shakyas, Devadatta, with whom the Buddha from very young age had, what should I say, troubled relationships. There was a lot of enmity and competition between the two of them. But Devadatta eventually becomes a disciple of the Buddha, but then there's further troubles with them. So I bring this up just to set a little bit of the scene. After the Buddha's father, King Suddhodana, passed away, and his stepmother and wife and various other family members joined the Sangha with the Buddha, General Mahanama became the king of Kapilavastu. And Kapilavastu was a neighbor to another kingdom, Kosala, and they had good relations. And in fact, the king of Kosala and the queen of Kosala and even the crown prince were Buddha's followers. In fact, many of Buddha's followers were kings and queens and generals, and of course others. We've talked about it in the past, and I can say more at a future time. Yet at certain point in time, the king Prasenajit was inspecting his subjects, and one of his sons, Prince Garuda Ara, staged a coup, seized power and killed his stepbrother, the crown prince Jetta. Now the king and his queen fled to Kapilavastu and sought political asylum there. King Prasenajit died of illness, and his queen continued to live in Kapilavastu. Meanwhile, Prince Garudara, sometimes he's called Garudara, sometimes called Garudana, but he became king of Kosala, and he declared war on Kapilavastu. Why did he declare war on Kapilavastu? He had been insulted, he felt, by betrayals of the Shakyas. How so? Well, his father had a first queen, and then that queen died, and the Shakyas were asked and agreed to send a princess of the Shakyas to be his queen. However, the Shakyas decided to play a trick on him, and instead of sending an actual member of the royal family, they sent a slave. They said she was royalty, but she wasn't. This is the queen who was the mother of Prince Garudara. Some point, Prince Garudara went to visit the Shakyas in Kapalivastu. And he was learned through some incidents, which I won't go into, that it turns out his mother, who he thought was royalty, really was a slave. And he was very angry about that, felt he had been insulted. So this was part of the reason he decided to declare war on the Shakyas. So then the sutra says, when the Buddha learned of the impending conflict between Kosala and Kapalivastu, he tried to stop the advancing Kosalan army by sitting under a dead tree at the border between Kosala and Kapalivastu, facing the advancing army of King Garudara. Though the king didn't like the Buddha, he stopped his chariot, and the sutra said, he asked him, you should be meditating under a Bodhi tree, not under a dead tree. The Buddha replied, you are right, but what is the use of a Bodhi tree without love and peace? The custom in India, the Indian subcontinent at that time, was that if an army came across a holy man, a religious man on the way to battle, they would retreat. Therefore, the Buddha, sitting there, knew this, and King Garudara, the Kosalan army, withdrew, returned home with his army. Now the sutra, as I said, there's a number of different versions in the sutras. So some say that there was a second assault and the same thing happened, and a third assault. Each time the Buddha was sitting under the dead tree facing the advancing army, and the army retreated. Some sutras say this only happened once. Some sutras say it happened twice. Some sutras say it happened three times. But the fourth time, the Buddha wasn't there. And the army of Kosala under King Rudara, or Rudana, marched straight into Kapalivastu. Ananda, who was a cousin of Buddhas and also a member of the Shakya tribe, one day said to the Buddha, my Lord Buddha, why are you so sad? The Buddha says, the Shakya people will be massacred in a week. They have broken international protocol and insulted a royal prince from their neighboring kingdom. They never felt sorry for what they did, nor gave an apology, meaning for this insult trick of sending a slave as a princess to be married to the king. The Buddha says, no matter what his ancestors were, a human being should be treated with respect. Therefore, the karma of the Shakya people has ripened, and there's little I can do to help. So then another of the Buddha's senior disciples, Maha Maggulayayana, said, but that is my country. He was also a Shakya. I will do whatever I can to help Kapalivastu out. The sutra says, the Buddha said, it is their sin, and no one will escape the law of karma. If they do not confess that they are wrong, no one can save them. So Maha Moggallana was famous for his various mystical powers. And the sutra says he flew to the city and put 500 Shakyas into his begging bowl. We don't have to go into this, but Then he took the bowl with him and he flew to safety. But when he opened his begging bowl, there weren't any people in there. Now he understood the law of karma, the sutras say. And after many days of war, the Shakyas surrendered. And in those days, surrendered means death. And King Virudhika ordered a massacre of all, it says, 30,000 Shakyas. I won't go into, there's further stories here that have to do with one, the general Mahanama. Another time I can talk about those, but they're besides the point. So the sutras say, thus King Virudhika, son of Buddha's devoted follower, killed his own family, meaning he killed his brother, and then he killed his mother who was living with the Shakyas, and he massacred another nation. Afterwards, something occurred, we don't know exactly what. Supposedly, he and his queen were killed, and another of Buddha's followers, King Ajatasattu of a neighboring kingdom, conquered both of these kingdoms, both Kosala and Kapilavastu, and he formed a larger kingdom. Some of you might remember this Ajatasattu. This is someone I mentioned earlier. He was used to be a prince, and he was very opposed to the Buddha. His father, King Bimbisara, was a disciple of the Buddha's. His mother had been also a disciple of the Buddha's. And his father's courtesan, or concubine, was also a disciple of the Buddha's. And in fact, she's the one who set up one of the first Buddhist monasteries by donating the land to the Buddha. Nevertheless, Ajatasattu killed his father, killed his brothers. He was both a regicide and a patricide. Yeah. And in the future, at some point, he started consulting the Buddha and became a major disciple of the Buddha. So this is the world that the Buddha lived in, a world where being a soldier, being a warrior, being a ruler was both normal to them, and the Buddha was acted as a consultant to many of these, and he encouraged them to do their duty, and yet at the same time, he attempted in various ways to make peace. Sometimes it worked, and as we see, sometimes it doesn't work. As the Buddha's statement makes clear, what's the problem in this case was people, the Shakyas, never felt sorry for what they did, for their, call it, major insult. We can learn from that if we don't give an apology. They never gave an apology. Therefore, the Buddha said, despite what I do, I can't stop it. I can't stop the war. I can't stop the slaughter of all my people unless they're willing to make their amends. So this is how the Buddha talks, acts in the time of war and in the time of not war. Both encouraging royalty, kings, generals, officers, warriors to do their duty, and yet to do it within, according to ways that help reduce suffering and harming. Now, of course, what's appropriate for a king, what's appropriate for a queen as a practice is very different than what's appropriate for someone who takes vows with the Buddha as a formal disciple, a bhikkhu or bhikkhuni. And as we know, many of the kings and queens, queens, some of them eventually became formal bhikkhunis. Many of the princes became bhikkhus from Ananda onwards, Devadatta, etc. So I bring this up just to look at the various aspects of how and what practice is in the time of war, in the time of conflict. How we do or don't get caught up in different sides and seeing what's called for in order to make peace. And that even the Buddha at some point says, this isn't going to work unless the others do their part. He can sit in front of the army. He could have kept on sitting in front of the army. What would have happened? But at some point, the Buddha said, I've done it. It's not going to happen. And he is said, the Buddha is said, Ananda says, my Lord Buddha, why are you so sad? And yet, despite the massacre of his people who he was connected to, and yet he also recognized what can or can't happen. What is his to do and what is others to do in order to change consequences, in order to make peace among peoples who hate each other, who have legitimate grievances on all sides. Okay. As the quote that I started with says, the whole world is a very narrow bridge. How we walk on it with no fear, giving no fear, being no fear, doing what's appropriate in the midst of clearly seeing the emptiness of all the five conditions, so that suffering is relieved, so-called our suffering, and so-called the suffering of all beings. Thank you.